Welcome to According to Sam, folks. This is episode 185. Thank you so much for watching. I'm going to get right back into where I left off in the last podcast. As I said in the last podcast, I had a lot more that I wanted to share with you. And we're going to get back into that in this podcast. And who knows if I mean, I have a lot of stuff here. If I don't get to everything, we'll probably pick this up on Friday, because this is very important. It's very, very important. And you'll see why as we go through this stuff. But the stuff that we're talking about that we were talking about in the last podcast, and what we're talking about in this podcast, this is at the very heart of the issues that Congress that they're debating right now. So my job is to help you understand what's going on, but understand it from a very nuts and bolts point of view. I want to say that if you're listening to this podcast on SoundCloud, in a few weeks, I'm going to stop using SoundCloud. The best place to get this podcast, if you want to listen to an audio version, is either on Spotify or Apple Podcast. And you can also watch the podcast on Substack. I've started to put the podcast there on Substack. So if you're listening on SoundCloud, in a few weeks, you won't be able to listen there anymore, but there'll be plenty other places where you can find the podcast. All right, so let's get into what I have for you guys today. And like I said, we're going to pick up where we left off in the last podcast. But I want to start with, a big story that is taking up a lot of the news right now. It's about these comments that Trump made over the weekend about NATO. And NATO is, again, at the very heart, and the expansion of NATO is at the very heart of what's going on in Ukraine and what we're going to talk about today. But let's take a listen to this clip. Let's get started. This is Marco Rubio yesterday on CNN, and let's get started.
And joining me now is the vice chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Republican Senator from Florida, Marco Rubio. Senator, thanks so much for joining us this morning. I know the NATO alliance is very important to you. You just pushed and got legislation to require the advice and consent of the Senate or an act of Congress before any president could suspend, terminate, or withdraw U.S. membership from NATO.
Listen to that. So Jake Tapper saying that you just talking to a Republican Marco Rubio, that you just working with a Democrat, working with Tim Kaine from Virginia, the two of them, Republican Marco Rubio and Democrat Tim Kaine, they worked on a piece of legislation to prevent the president of the United States, because they're expecting Trump to come in next January. So if Trump comes in next January, no matter if it's Trump, whoever it is, down the line, that they have to, the president of the United States, commander in chief of the military. And I saw Steve Bannon today talking about this, and he's saying that this is unconstitutional, this resolution that Tim Kaine and Marco Rubio got passed, that I think they put it in with another bill that passed, but it was an amendment, that the president of the United States has to advise and get consent from the Senate before he can pull us out of a military alliance. He's the commander in chief. So Marco Rubio, Republican, worked with Democrat Tim Kaine to get that piece of legislation passed. That's what Jake Tapper is referring to here. Let's listen to the rest of this.
Marco Rubio. Senator, thanks so much for joining us this morning. I know the NATO alliance is very important to you. You just pushed and got legislation to require the advice and consent of the Senate or an act of Congress before any president could suspend, terminate, or withdraw U.S. membership from NATO. So I want you to take a listen to something Donald Trump said yesterday on the campaign trail.
The presidents of a big country stood up and said, well, sir, if we don't pay and we're attacked by Russia, will you protect us? I said, you didn't pay? You're delinquent? He said, yes, let's say that happened. No, I would not protect you. In fact, I would encourage them to do whatever the hell they want. You got to pay.
You got to pay.
You've endorsed Donald Trump. Are you comfortable with him suggesting that he wouldn't defend NATO countries and actually he would invite Putin and Russia to invade them?
That's not what he said.
Well, that's not what happened, and that's not how I view that statement. I mean, he was talking about something, a story that he talked about happened in the past. By the way, Donald Trump was president, and he didn't pull aside in NATO. You know, in fact, American troops were stationed throughout Europe, as they are today. They were then as well. But he's telling a story, and frankly, look, Donald Trump is not a member of the Council of Foreign Relations. He doesn't talk like a traditional politician. And we've already been through this now. You'd think people had figured it out by now. What he's basically saying is, if you see the comments, he said NATO was broke or busted until he took over because people weren't paying their dues. And then he told the story about how he used leverage to get people to step up to the plate and become more active in NATO. He's not the first American president. In fact, virtually every American president at some point in some way has complained about other countries in NATO not doing enough. You know, Trump's just the first one to express it in these terms. But
so Marco Rubio was stellar in this interview. I don't trust Marco Rubio. I'm going to show you why here in a moment. I mean, I just told you a little bit of why that he worked with Tim Kaine to pass this resolution that the president of the United States, the commander in chief, can't pull us out of a military alliance. And there's other reasons, which I'm going to show you, that I don't really trust Marco Rubio. But Marco Rubio was excellent in this interview. And he's 100% right when he says that Trump was just telling a story about how he got the NATO alliance to pay up. This was an interview on, I think it was Meet the Press yesterday. And listen to what this journalist says. She says she spoke to the head of the NATO alliance, and this
it's
is
a good thing
says
for the transatlantic alliance. It's obviously a political issue. We're talking about the campaign, but I spoke to the former NATO chief not too long ago, and he did point out the one good thing former President Trump did, was get the NATO allies to increase their contributions, which is a good
thing. So Trump actually got the NATO alliance to increase their contribution. He's telling a story about how you may not like his tactics. You may not like his style, but he's telling a story in his campaign event about how he got the NATO alliance to increase their contributions. And now the big story is that he said that he gave Russia the green light to invade Europe. What's wrong with you people? What's wrong with you people? But this was one of my favorite parts of this this interview with Marco Rubio, because it goes back to the last podcast and the title of the last podcast, which was priorities and where our priorities are. Are our priorities going to be in Ukraine and in Israel and in Taiwan, or are we going to have domestic priorities, especially since we are borrowing all this money? Are we going to borrow money for all these other countries, or are we going to borrow money for ourselves? What we really need to be doing is cutting spending and taking care of our debt. But listen to Marco Rubio here.
I want to get to border in a second, but just to clarify something, are you in support of aid to Ukraine?
I think if we secure our own border here in the United States, I've said that we should help Ukraine. Look, half the money that's going to Ukraine is not going to Ukraine. It's to buy back our own weapons that we gave them, to restock our own shelves. And obviously, Taiwan is included
if that's the truth, that we got to buy back our own weapons because our arsenal is so depleted. Wow.
We should help Ukraine. Look, half the money that's going to Ukraine is not going to Ukraine. It's to buy back our own weapons that we gave them, to restock our own shelves. And obviously, Taiwan is included there as well. My problem is this. Before we do these things, we have to make America and Americans a priority again in city after city now.
We have to make America and Americans a priority again. Well, why haven't we been a priority, first of all? I mean, this is a damning accusation that Senator Marco Rubio, who's been in the Senate for over a decade, that he's making here, that that the Americans and the American people have not been a priority. Well, why haven't we been a priority, Marco Rubio? And like I said, I don't trust this guy. But another reason I don't trust him is you remember back in 2016 when I told the story before, Trump is there, Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio is on stage, Ted Cruz is on stage, Ben Carson's on stage, and Donald Trump is hammering Jeb Bush. And take a listen to how Marco Rubio comes to Jeb Bush's defense.
I just want to say, at least on behalf of me and my family, I thank God all the time that it was George W. Bush in the White House on 9/11 and not Al Gore. I think you can look back in hindsight and say a couple things, but he kept us safe. And not only did he keep us safe, but no matter what you want to say about weapons of mass destruction, Saddam Hussein was in violation of UN resolutions, an open violation, and the world wouldn't do anything about it. And George W. Bush enforced what the international community refused to do. And again, he kept us safe, and I am forever grateful to what he did for this
country. How did he keep us safe when the World Trade Center came down? I lost hundreds of friends. The World Trade Center came down during the reign of George. He kept us safe. That's not safe. That is not safe, Marco.
All right. That's not safe.
That is not safe.
The World Trade Center came down because Bill Clinton didn't kill Osama bin Laden when he had the chance to kill him.
And George Bush had the
chance. You see, Marco Rubio? Marco Rubio tries to blame it on Bill Clinton and make it partisan. It's not partisan. I mean, Bill Clinton and George Bush are part of the same cabal.
They came down because Bill Clinton didn't kill Osama bin Laden when he had the chance to kill him.
And George Bush had the chance. By the way, George Bush had the chance also, and he didn't listen to the advice of his CIA.
George Bush didn't listen to his CIA. No one can. We have the CIA warning that he got a month before 9/11. Titled Bin Laden Determined to Attack in the United States. He knew they were here. He didn't listen to it. He didn't keep us safe. It's ridiculous to say that he kept us safe. But this guy, he is one of the founding members of the Lincoln Project, and his name is Reed Galen. One of the founding members of the Lincoln Project. And if you don't know, the Lincoln Project or a group of Republicans, people who ran campaigns like Mitt Romney's campaign, John McCain's campaign, failed campaigns, campaigns that didn't win. They were aligned with the neocon Bush wing of the party. And ever since Trump has been the leader of the party, these people have been working to destroy the party and destroy the MAGA movement. So I want you to listen to what Reed Galen says here, and then we'll discuss it.
Feels like, which is she, unlike
oh, I just
her,
want to make sure,
you know, home state know senator.
He's talking about Nikki Haley here, and he's saying why Nikki Haley should stay in the race because Nikki Haley represents a faction of the Republican Party that is in at odds with the Make America Great Again faction of the Republican Party, because there's two factions in the Republican Party. There's the Make America Again Great Again faction, Make America Great Again America First faction, and then there is the faction that Reed Galen says here. Now take a listen.
Well, I will say this. Ambassador Haley just cut about 72 Lincoln Project ads that will run about 6 million times in the course of the next 9 months. But what I would say this is, too, is that, look, she's understood now what it feels like, which is she, unlike her, you know, home state senator, Tim Scott, is not up for ritual humiliation. She's going to go out. She's going to go out swinging. And so I'll say this. Like, I think we need to impart a little bit of three-dimensional chess here, gang. Right. Okay. She's not going to be the nominee. Fine. Right. But here's what I can tell you. The longer she's in the race saying stuff like she said after Nevada, the better for the country, because there are a whole bunch of Republicans that we saw in Iowa, that we saw in Nevada. And look, 31%. Trump can't afford to lose half of that. He can't afford to lose a third of that. He can't afford to lose 20% of that when it comes to Republicans. And so every day she's out there saying this, there are more and more Republicans, and I think I've said this to you before, Stephanie, who see Nikki as someone they used to support, a Mitt Romney, a John McCain, a George W. Bush. That's the party they want back. And so, yes, is
a Mitt Romney, a John McCain, a George Bush, that's the party that they want back. I mean, let's think about this, people. Is that the party that we want back? We want the George Bush, Mitt Romney, John McCain party back. And he's saying that that's who Nikki Haley represents. The Mitt Romney, George Bush, and John McCain. Well, George Bush, just finished talking about him. This guy comes into office in a very scandalous way, quite frankly, in a 5-4 Supreme Court decision. He becomes president. And within a year of becoming president, well, not even a year, a few months of becoming president, we have a terrorist attack in the United States. We have evidence that this guy's warned the entire time through those first 7 months before the attack. We have one of the CIA documents that he received at his ranch in Crawford telling him that terrorists were in the country and that they were planning, even that gives them the method of attack, that they're planning on hijacking planes. It's all in the document. The 9/11 happens. He parlays that into a war that he lies us into completely. He runs up the debt. When he comes into office in 2001, the government was running a surplus. He's the one who started the deficit spending, and we've been deficit spending ever since. Is that the Republican Party that you want to go back to? To the Republican Party of George Bush or Mitt Romney. Let's talk about Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney was the governor of Massachusetts. He instituted Romney Care in Massachusetts, which became the framework for Obamacare. He ran against Obama and lost after Obama had a terrible first term. I remember Laura Ingraham back in 2012 famously saying that if the Republican Party cannot beat Obama with this record, then they ought to hang it up. Obama loses 4 million votes in 2012. Romney didn't beat him. And I remember after Romney lost, remember the Ranks Priebus and the GOP, they issue an autopsy report. The party was dead. They issued an autopsy report on the party and how the party needs to, you know, accept illegal immigration and be more friendly to the gays and all this stuff. So Romney, is that really the party that you want to go back to? You want to go back to the party of Romney? Or let's talk about John McCain. Let's talk about John McCain. So you guys remember after 9/11, in the weeks after 9/11, if you're old enough to remember and you lived through this, that someone started mailing anthrax around to news companies. Some anthrax was sent to a news company in Florida. A lot was sent to the corporations, news corporations, NBC, ABC in New York. There were people dying. And this letter was in the envelope with the anthrax. This is a version of the letter. And it says 9/11/01. So September 11, 2001. So the letter is making a release. It's just weeks after 9/11. The letter is making a relationship to 9/11. It says, this is next. Take penicillin now. Death to America. Death to Israel. Allah is great. That's what the letter said. And this anthrax was being mailed through the parcel system, and people were dying just weeks after 9/11. People were frantic. They didn't know what was going on. And when you're looking back in hindsight, you know that this is the beginning of the narrative about chemical and biological weapons, because they're going to pin this on Iraq. John McCain comes out, and this is, he goes on the David Letterman show. And this is about the time where everybody's frantic. We had just had a terrorist attack that killed 3,000 Americans. Now people are dying because this anthrax is being mailed around. We don't know what to think. John McCain goes on the David Letterman show, and take a listen to what he says.
Afghanistan now.
I think we're doing fine. I think we'll do fine. The second phase, if I could just make it very quickly, the second phase is Iraq. There is some indication, and I don't have the conclusions, but some of this anthrax may, and I emphasize may, have come from Iraq.
No, there was no indication. Listen to what he says. There's some indication, and I emphasize may, that this anthrax may be coming from Iraq.
Conclusions, but some of this anthrax may, and I emphasize may, have come from Iraq.
No, so none of the anthrax was coming from Iraq, people. This was American anthrax. Now, this was an obvious setup. Someone impersonating a Muslim. They want you to think it's a Muslim. Allah is great. Death to America, death to Israel. This is American anthrax. We know without a doubt it's the Ames strand of anthrax that was created in Ames, Iowa. But this was American anthrax that was being shipped around, and someone impersonating a Muslim to make Americans think that this was a second wave attack from Muslim extremists. It had nothing to do with Iraq. But John McCain went on David Letterman, and he went to perpetuate the narrative about Iraq so he can help the Bush administration start building this case, this phony case against Iraq to take us to war in Iraq. I tell you all that because John McCain was in Ukraine pumping up the people and the war in Ukraine. This is the man that the Lincoln Project wants to take us back to. He wants to take us back to a Republican Party of George Bush, of Mitt Romney, and John McCain. And he says that people want to go back to that Republican Party. You want to go back to this Republican Party? Let me tell you what John McCain did. So picking up where we left off in the last podcast, Viktor Yanukovych was president, and he was ending his term as president. And he's negotiating a trade deal for Ukraine to join the EU in a trade agreement and or with Russia. Actually, the deal that was being negotiated, Yanukovych was first negotiating with the EU, and Yanukovych was considering it because he thought that this would be great for the people of Ukraine. And he was looking to do a trade deal. So and I think this is very significant too, that Yanukovych agrees tentatively with the agreement with the EU before Russia even gets involved. So that even shows, because everyone says that Yanukovych was this pro Russian president. If he was such a pro-Russian president, why would he even agree tentatively to the deal with the EU and the European Union? But he agreed tentatively with this trade deal with the European Union, and Russia gets involved. Vladimir Putin says it himself in the interview he did with Tucker Carlson last week, that when we got wind of this deal, that we told Yanukovych we're going to shut down our borders. And because we don't want our country to be flooded with a bunch of goods from the EU. So we have to shut down our borders. That makes plenty of sense. And then Yanukovych starts to calculate, and this is even what Yanukovych says in the interview he does with Oliver Stone in Ukraine on Friday. He says he starts calculating and seeing what the best deal was for the people of Ukraine. And Putin sweetens the deal and says that we're going to give you $15 billion. And Russia made a better offer to Yanukovych for the Ukrainian people. Yanukovych backs out of the deal with the EU, and he accepts the deal with Russia. And what happens after that, as Putin says, that the opposition took disastrous measures after that. So what happened after that? What happened after that is George Soros has been organizing in Ukraine since the 1990s. And I played the clips of George Soros saying that from this interview. This interview, I'm going to play quite a bit of it because George Soros' English is not his first language. It takes some time to get through this stuff, but he tells you so much in this interview. And this interview was in 2015. Again, he's being interviewed by Christina Freeland, who's the current deputy prime minister in Canada. And we're going to listen to a few clips of George Soros to bring us back to where we were at the end of the podcast yesterday. And let's take it from here.
I set up the foundation in Ukraine in 1990, which was 2 years before the independence of Ukraine. That was part. It was an offshoot of the foundation in Russia. You know, I set up a cultural initiative foundation in the Soviet Union in 1987, and then we built this branch in Ukraine.
So in the Soviet Union, he started with this foundation in Soviet Union in 87, and then in 1990 he builds branches off from the Soviet Union into Ukraine with his foundation
in 1990, the foundation. One of the things that the foundation did gave a lot of scholarships and supported civil society, and the maturity of civil society 25 years later is, to a large extent, the work of the foundation.
Listen to what he's saying. He's saying that what happens in 2014, 25 years later, at Maidan, is an extension of the work done from the foundation. That I started the foundation in 1990s, given scholarships. He's going to... I'm going to play another clip here in a moment. What he says, what the work that I do is called political philanthropy. This is what he says. You're going to hear him say that in a moment, that what I do is political philanthropy. So what he did in 1990, he came into Ukraine, set up his foundation, giving scholarship, organizing, getting people together. And what he says is that what happens 25 years later, in 2014, at Maidan, is an extension from all of the work that we've done over the last 30 years of the foundation, the organizing, the scholarships, what happened in 2014 was because of the work that we have been doing in Ukraine with the foundation. All right, let's listen to more.
Civil society, 25 years later, is, to a large extent, the work of the foundation.
Yeah, and I will just offer my own personal testimony here. It's actually amazing in Ukraine. The new Ukrainian government, the new Ukrainian leadership.
The new Ukraine.
Everyone.
Don't forget that from last podcast, that George Soros, he's the one who's making the distinction between the old Ukraine and the new Ukraine. So we're talking about the new Ukraine. And he said that the new Ukraine started after 2014 with Euromaidan.
I know in that group has been touched somehow.
Okay, hold on. Let me go back
Ukraine,
here.
Ukraine, the new Ukrainian government, the new Ukrainian leadership. Everyone who I know in that leadership group has been touched.
The new Ukrainian leadership. So this is in 2015. This is before the election of Poroshenko. Oh, my God. There's so much that I got to tell you guys, because the new, when she's talking about the new Ukrainian government, when this interview is she's talking about the government that we put in place after the coup. So the new Ukrainian government in the new Ukraine is an extension of the open society, is what she's essentially going to say.
Actually, amazing in Ukraine, the new Ukrainian government, the new Ukrainian leadership. Everyone who I know in that group has been touched somehow by open society and by George, like literally either people personally got a scholarship or someone, you know, their wife got a scholarship. It's a really remarkable thing.
Well, this is quite an experience to see this. And I didn't realize actually how big an effect it has had over a 25-year period, because those were students. 25 years later, they were leaders.
Yeah, they were students, and then now they're leaders, huh? All right. And the thing is that you people need to understand is that this guy is doing the same thing here in the United States, his political philanthropy. Open society, he's getting DAs elected, Black Lives Matter. If you guys really understand how the color revolution was run in Ukraine in 2014, you know that they just, and I'm going to explain that to you, that they just ran the exact same thing here in 2020 with Black Lives Matter. I'm going to explain it to you how it went down, but it was the same type of color revolution, except in 2020, the color was black. Here is another clip from George Soros. Let's take a listen.
I think I can take a historical perspective, because I was very much involved in the collapse of the Soviet system. That was my debut as a, what I call myself, a political philanthropist.
Political philanthropist. And that's what he thinks he's doing, is political philanthropy. That's what he calls himself. Take note of that, because there's another clip that I'm going to show you here in a moment, that he calls himself and what he does, what he's doing here in the United States, getting all these DAs who are not in keeping criminals in jail and supporting liberal politics and liberal candidates, supporting, like I said, the protests in 2020 with Black Lives Matter, what he did in Russia, what he did in Ukraine. He calls that political philanthropy, political philanthropy. So this question that Freeland asks him is about Russia. I don't think there's more of this to play.
This is déjà vu for me. But there are some fundamental differences between now and...
I think I'm done with that clip. Okay, so here's the last George Soros clip that we're going to play, and then we're going to start talking about the Nazis. So George Soros, again, described what he does and what he said what he does as political philanthropy. But now what they're going to talk about is his investment into Ukraine. And investment is not philanthropy. People invest to get a return on their investment. Philanthropy is giving money away. So take a listen to George Soros and Christina Freeland talk about his investment into Ukraine.
As we've discussed, you've been involved in Ukraine and in the former Soviet Union for many, many years. You recently made quite a dramatic announcement about being willing to really put your money where your mouth is when it comes to Ukraine. This announcement of a possible $1 billion investment, private business investment in Ukraine.
So a billion-dollar investment. This is his political philanthropy. A billion-dollar investment is what he's made into private business into Ukraine. Okay, listen to more of this.
It reminded me a little bit of, remember that Russian investment? When you got very excited.
I hope that I won't repeat. I mentioned earlier, I'm a practitioner of fallibility, but I hope that this time I won't make the same. I think making the same mistake twice would be too much.
So he lost money in Russia.
So having made that...
He lost a bunch of money in Russia. So he says he's not going to make the same mistake twice. So that means that with this investment, I need to make sure that I get a return on this investment. So I won't be making the same mistake twice, that I have some assurances that this investment is going to come through.
Russian mistake, having been very open with yourself and the world about it being a mistake, what's motivated you to put this idea forward, and do you think it will actually be possible? Is it going to help lead the change?
Well, that comes back to your earlier question of, is there a way of to regain the initiative? And I think there has to be a way, and if that could be accomplished, then Ukraine would be a very attractive investment opportunity. So I think...
Not for him. So this is what he's saying. He's saying that it's not only me. Yeah, I got $1 billion in it, but for other people, maybe Nancy Pelosi wants to put a little money into Ukraine. Maybe Joe Biden's got a little bit of money in Ukraine in this investment. Who else has some money in this investment? Does Lindsey Graham have any money in this investment? Does Christopher Murphy, who we played in the last podcast, who was up there, getting all this started, does he have any money in this investment? Because George Soros is saying that this has the potential of being a very attractive investment if we do it right. This is what he's saying.
Then Ukraine would be a very attractive investment opportunity. So I think the possibility of turning the situation around is there. But right now, Putin is actually gaining ground or has been gaining ground. Actually, I rather think that we may have passed the peak of that. It's a little too early to say, but I think just the events of the last week or two give me hope that it's always darkest before dawn. I see some signs of the thing turning around, and that we can go into it why. But at any rate, Putin has had the initiative, and he still does have that, because his aim, his optimum aim in Ukraine is not to have a military victory that would give him control over part of Ukraine, mainly.
I just want to stop this real quick to make sure that we understand. We're still talking about his investment. So he's getting into talking about Russia and Putin, and this is 2015. Putin doesn't invade Ukraine until 2022. The war in Donbass is going on. There's still a war. Russia is supporting the rebellion there in Donbass. So that's where we are. He's talking about that war, but we're still talking about his investment. So don't lose sight of that.
Part. but also responsibility. With control goes responsibility. So he doesn't want part of Ukraine. He wants to destabilize all of Ukraine, and preferably in a way that he can disclaim responsibility. That's his sort of the maximum that he's aiming for. And he's willing to, he's already shown, so I'm not, this is not a construction on my part or a guess. It's his demonstrated behavior, because twice he has traded in, converted a sure military victory into a ceasefire that would hopefully bring about a financial crisis and a political a collapse of Ukraine. This was Minsk 1 and Minsk 2. And if
he's
you compare
about the Minsk agreements there, he's saying that Putin wanted to do the Minsk agreements to negotiate a ceasefire. I mean, I can play clips of Angela Merkel saying that from the German and French point of view, that the Minsk agreements were just the stalling tactic so they could build up their artillery. So this is what he's saying here is not necessarily true. But again, we're still talking about his investment.
The two, you can see how much progress he has made on the ground. And that has been acknowledged, recognized, and at the same time, he has not given up any of his options. So he can switch from a hybrid war to hybrid peace, and back again. So he has the initiative. So you need to first of all get equal. And have
first of all, get equal. So what is he talking there? That they need to diminish. And this is what Putin said in the interview with Tucker Carlson. I'm not going to even be able to get into the Nazis today. I'm looking at, I can see that I'm not going to have time to get into the Nazis. So we'll get into the Nazis on Friday. But what he's saying here, and this is what Putin said in the interview with Tucker Carlson here. Let me get that real quick. I want you to listen to that part of the interview. Go. Okay. This is what, take a listen to what Putin says here.
Nuclear conflict?
At least that's what they're talking about, and they're trying to intimidate their own people. And a global war will bring all humanity to the brink of destruction. It's obvious. There are certainly means of deterrence. They have been scaring everyone with us all along. Tomorrow Russia will use tactical nuclear weapons. Tomorrow Russia will use that. No, the day after tomorrow. So what? In order to extort additional money from U.S. taxpayers and European taxpayers.
So he's basically saying that they're using the Russia threat and the threat of Russia to extort money from American taxpayers and U.S. taxpayers. This is the claim that Putin makes, that they're using the Russian scare, the Red Scare, the Russian threat to extort money from American and European taxpayers. Listen again.
In order to extort additional money from U.S. taxpayers and European taxpayers in the confrontation with Russia in the Ukrainian theater of war. The goal is to weaken Russia as much as possible.
The goal is to weaken Russia as much as possible. That's what George Soros is talking here. He says that the goal is to weaken Russia, to make Russia equal to Ukraine to give Ukraine a better negotiating chip that if they weaken Russia, if we throw enough money at this that we can weaken Russia, that will give the Ukrainian government of whatever is left of Ukraine at that time a better negotiating position. So that's what George Soros is talking about here.
Sure. And back again. So he has the initiative. So you need to, first of all, get equal and have options. Having done that, eventually you could, and then you need a strategy that would...
still talking about his investment.
Change the current regime where Ukraine is barely given enough to survive, to actually...
So he's talking he's talking about Putin, that we need a strategy to change the current regime in Russia. That's what he's talking about here. Listen to him say it again. We need a strategy to change the current... We're still talking about his investment.
The current regime change the current regime where Ukraine is barely given enough to survive, to actually being given a lot more budgetary support and also
what is Ukraine getting more budgetary support have to do with your investment, George Soros?
Additional support that would attract private capital, because it's really the inflow of private capital that would make the Ukrainian economy work.
I've heard there's a hedge fund guy in New York who wants to invest $1 billion, so that's a start.
Well, that's exactly why I put it up there. And just for the record, I made it clear that it is for profit, not for loss. But the profits will go to the foundation not to me personally, so that I can't be accused of, you know, just doing it to make a killing. But I think that if things work out well, I would make a killing by investing in Ukraine.
If things work out well. So, I mean, there's a lot there. I know that it's hard to get through because his English isn't his first language and he's old. But he says a lot there. He says, first of all, when they start talking about this, that... he lost a bunch of money in an investment in Russia. Not going to make the same mistake this time. This time, in this investment, $1 billion investment, I got to have some assurances because I'm not going to make the same mistake that I made in that Russia investment. And then he goes into all this stuff about Putin and, investing into the Ukrainian budget and the war there and the Minsk agreement. This is all pertaining to his investment. And he says that don't worry, when I make all this money, it's going to go to the foundation, the political philanthropy foundation. Don't worry. I'm not just in it to make a killing. But if things work out well, I'm going to make a killing. If things work out well in Ukraine, I'm going to make a killing. And my question is, how many other people are going to make a killing if things work out well in Ukraine? Who's going to make a killing? Is George Soros the only one making a killing? Or is some other people going to be making a killing too? So George Soros, he's the one who got the people to Maidan. And any of this talk about the protest in the Maidan being spontaneous, that was in the clip that I played in the last podcast where he said that After the trade agreement with the EU fell apart and Yanukovych started, making an agreement with Russia, that the people spontaneously came out to the Maidan. There was nothing spontaneous about it. According to George Soros himself, he had been there organizing for 25 years. The same kids he gave scholarships to 25 years ago are the same people that showed up to Maidan. It was easy because of the organization that Open Society had done in Ukraine for 25 years. It was very easy for Open Society to call 100,000 people together like that. So as soon as the trade deal broke down, George Soros and Open Society called the people out to protest. And the demonstrations were peaceful. But then Clown McCain and Chris Murphy from Connecticut, two American senators, are over there rallying. Do you have any money invested, Chris Murphy, in the success of Ukraine? How about you, John McCain? I know you're dead, but does your wife have any money in the success of Ukraine? Huh? What are you guys over there doing, meddling in their business and their trade agreements? On the other side of the world. Why? You guys have any money invested is what I want to know. But there was nothing, absolutely nothing spontaneous about this gathering. Nothing spontaneous. George Soros called this gathering. Open Society called this gathering. You heard him say it himself. The very people we gave scholarships to 25 years ago were the leaders of today. So this is how Euromaidan started. And again, it was 100% peaceful. This is what they did with Black Lives Matter. And this is what the relationship that I wanted to make. And this is all, just set us up for Friday. But in the United States, when the Black Lives Matter George Floyd protests came out, they were peaceful. They were exercising their First Amendment right. During the daytime. That's why the whole meme came about mostly peaceful protests, because the media would come out and they would give cover to the legitimate peaceful protests that were taking place during the day. But at night, when the sun went down, the Antifa element was coming in and they were doing the looting, and they were setting the fires, and they were doing the violence, and then the sun would come up, and they were peaceful, la, 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 peaceful. And then the sun would go down, and then the Antifa would start doing the violence. That's what happened in Ukraine. It's the exact same color revolution. At the peaceful revolution, these guys were peaceful, and they gave cover to the Nazis when the Nazis showed up. And that's what we're going to talk about on Friday. I just want to say this. Now, look at the country of Ukraine. Now, what goes on here in Kiev, and all this stuff is going on here in Kiev, the people in Crimea, the people in Odessa, the people in the Donbas region, they're watching Euromaidan happen on TV. They don't necessarily agree with the coup d'etat that is happening in their capital city. So that's what you got to understand before we get into the next podcast next week, that these people in Ukraine, they're Ukrainians in Odessa, in Crimea, in Donbass, they're watching what George Soros and the American government are doing in Kiev, and they're processing that, okay? So, That just gets us started on what we're going to talk about in the next podcast. And we're going to get into the Nazis. I just thought that it was important to add more context today. So again, I'll see you guys on Friday, and I hope you enjoyed it.